out, something is going to get you tonight. Let's talk about the thing that's going to get you tonight.
Welcome to the Happy Harvest Horror Show.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Brian, and this is the Happy Harvest Horror Show, where we get together and talk about our favorite spooky things. And this week, it's the return of spooky Catholics and podcast favorite Connor Bryant. Welcome back. Connor, how are you doing?
I'm great. I'm so happy to be back on the podcast. I feel like it's been a really long time, but it's nice that we're doing more spooky Catholic adjacent material for this episode. I'm very excited.
Was it Midnight Mass the last time you were on?
It might have been. No. Actually, you know what? I think the last time that I was on, we were doing our episode about grief.
Oh, yeah. Grief. Well, since then, there have been multiple Flanagan projects and a lot of grief horror, you know? So we have a lot to catch up on. But we are continuing our spooky Catholic adjacent series with exorcisms today, talking about a little bit about that. But you know the drill. Before we get into that, I'm dying to know how spooky your week was. So, Connor, what kind of spooky stuff were you up to this week?
You know, my week wasn't actually particularly spooky, but since the last time that I saw you, the very end of March, I went home for my birthday, and the flight from LaGuardia to the Raleigh-Durham airport was the scariest turbulence I have ever experienced in my entire life.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, it was, and it was turbulence on the ascent. So we had not even reached our cruising altitude. And I don't know if that has ever happened to me before, but, and you know what? It honestly probably only lasted about 60 seconds, but it was the longest 60 seconds of my life. And I was in mortal terror. And it did make me have to sort of like reevaluate my relationship with God. Because I was just thinking, and it was the day before my birthday, and I thought, am I really going to die in this airplane the day before my 29th birthday? And I didn't, because here I am. But that was very scary. And then also, actually, something spooky that happened today. I think a friend of mine texted me a picture of a spooky church in Brooklyn, and I think that it's the church that we went to where Grady Hendrix had his author event for How to Sell a Haunted House. But I'm not positive, but I think it's the same church. But
that church is pretty spooky. I like that church.
That church was really spooky. Yeah, that was fun. That was great fun.
I like that. They had some good pews. I
good pews.
Some like good old pews, you know.
Yeah.
It's when churches get, you know, like, you know, my church had like the rock and roll mass. Like the Sunday night right. mass, you know, yes. And like when they get like really modern and like light beige, that I'm kind of out. But I love an old church.
Right well, on. Brian, how spooky was your week?
Well, it was pretty spooky. This has been a couple weeks now, but I did go to the Overlook Film Festival in New Orleans. Yes. So I was also flying. I think the same weekend you were flying. My flight landed A-okay.
Excellent.
All good. No Sully moment with the takeoff. But yeah, the festival was awesome. I got to see a lot of cool people, meet a lot of really cool people, saw a lot of amazing movies. I got an early screening of both Renfield and Evil Dead Rise, which are both coming out next couple of weeks and are both very fun. I also got a sneak preview of Talk to Me, just the new horror movie. And oh man, I keep like, I'm probably going to be saying this until July when it comes out, but y'all buckle up because this movie fucking, this goes so hard. As an audience, like, it was like a secret screening and we all got to see it during the festival. We all like for the rest of the weekend, we're kind of shook by it a little bit.
Wow.
It was everyone was talking about it. And then by the end of the festival, that was kind of the clear favorite of like, Talk to Me ruled. But I'm not going to get spoilery. I can't wait for everyone to see it in July and then we can all talk about it and have our thoughts about it. But yeah, it's rad. So that's my spooky week, you know.
It's very spooky.
Yeah, that's pretty good. That's pretty good, you know, going to New Orleans to see a bunch of horror movies. New Orleans itself too was awesome. I went to the Vampire Boutique store and the Vampire Cafe, got my own little, you know, blood bag. And upon a recommendation from a listener, I went back to the Vampire Boutique and got a little like a password from one of the people there. And there is a bar.
I think so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the French Quarter, where if you go in and go to the back of the bar, give them this like special password, there is a secret vampire speakeasy like on the second floor, and I got to go up there.
That
and that was really cool. And I even like walking up there, it was like 4 o'clock in the afternoon because I had to fit it in with all these movies, but it was like old couches and whatnot. It's really like speakeasy, and there was a woman there that was sitting at the bar that I talked to for a little bit, and she was in New Orleans that weekend for a ragtime festival, and so she was dressed in full 1920s like attire. It was just such a like a little magical like 30 minutes of like going to the back of this jazz bar, like sneaking in, you know, giving this password to this bouncer that had fangs, and then he let me in, you know, to this. Well,
or is that just what she told you, and really she's a vampire and she just hasn't changed out
or of her she clothes just from when wasn't she was even turned. There it was a ghost. Exactly,
it was a ghost.
I'm paying my bill and the bartender's like, who are you talking to? So awesome. Yeah, that was all super fun. So I had a pretty good weekend, and I'm looking forward to already going back with a group next year, because this time I went solo and that was also pretty spooky.
Yeah, I'll have to join you when the timing works out better. I was sad that I couldn't go, and especially Talk to Me is the one movie that I was really envious that you got to see that already, because I'm so ready for it.
It's fun. I can't wait for everyone to see it. Okay, so that was my spooky week. We got a lot going on here at the Happy Harvest Horror Show. I just also wanted to give you a quick plug before we go on a break that we have a book club. We love books at Happy Harvest Horror Show, and that club is still going strong. If you'd like any more information, just head on over to Happy Harvest Horror Show's Instagram, and we'll get all the information on that. But yeah, Connor, let's just take a quick little break, get some words from our little, you know, Spotify for podcaster sponsors, and we'll come back and let's talk about the fun exercise of exorcism.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And we're back. Welcome back. We're talking exorcisms today. Connor, you are a fellow Catholic, raised Catholic person, fellow man. What's your history with exorcisms? I'm sure you've never been part of one, but I feel like Catholic boy has like a, or Catholic just in general has like a deep connection to what that is.
Well, first of all, I can't believe that you are so sure that I've never been part of one.
Oh, man, this could be fun.
Wow. I've not ever been part of one. And I don't know when I first became aware of exorcism as a thing. I don't have like a distinct memory of, I don't know, like seeing a movie or, you know, it's like seeing The Exorcist and then like making the realization that like, oh, actually, this is part of the belief system that I, you know, am in right now. Yeah, I sort of wish that I had like a really formative sort of experience and that there was a story behind that, but I don't really. But I do remember being very fascinated by it because it's inherently one of the more fantastical sort of elements of Catholicism. And I don't remember any of my relatives approaching it with any real degree of skepticism. It seemed like everybody I knew really bought into it. Not that they themselves had personal experiences with it, but because it's so official and because it's taken so seriously, and you know the Vatican has to appoint you know special priests to be exorcists and all of that. I think it was approached with a degree of seriousness that made me think, oh, I guess this is legit. So yeah, but I never witnessed anything. I don't even think I even knew a priest. We had a lot of priests go through our church, and I don't think any of them were trained to be exorcists that I'm aware of. And I'm sure I asked. Yeah, but what about you? I'm sure that I asked.
I think it is such a common thing. I feel like I've asked like five priests. So when I was a kid, which was easy when you grew up in a Catholic school because priests were available. You know, I feel like nowadays it's like, am I going to go find a priest? I feel like The Exorcist, the movie, that's always the big one, you know, that like, you see that early and that's like, oh shit, this really scared me. And I feel like we're always kind of told about demons and you know, the influence of the devil, but like, you know, and then you see a movie like The Exorcist that I feel like it scared so many God-fearing people just because of how visceral and blasphemous the imagery and everything was. But I don't know if that was I do remember specifically like going to a sleepover when I was in high school with like with some guy, and that's always a thing, you know, you watch a scary movie. But I do remember this specific sleepover. We watched Exorcist the Beginning.
Oh yeah.
The prequel, and remember getting pretty freaked out about it. And I was laughing because I was remembering this at that sleepover of the five guys that were there, including myself. Two of them are now priests, and I host a scary podcast. So like, I don't want to say that night and then the movie Exorcist the Beginning was a formative moment, but like that is a crossroads between all of us, you know?
Indeed. Wow.
That's just so funny. But that same group of people, I do remember also later, because I was, I don't know if we said in earlier, you know, spooky Catholics, you know, podcasts, but when I was young, I like seriously considered priesthood as a vocation when I was, you know, growing up, and early high school, like took a trip with two of the guys that were at this little slumber party to St. Paul, Minnesota, to visit, you know, the seminary there and whatnot. And on the drive there, we were driven by two priests. I'd like to think I was the one that asked, but somebody in the car asked the priest, like, exorcisms, what's the deal? You ever done one? You know?
And then the priest just pull over to the side of the road.
Right. Well, kind of. Like, it got really quiet and, like, not in, like, it was like he was like a. He answered the question like, there was one time I helped this. I can't remember the specifics of the story, but I do remember like in the story, he was saying he didn't tell any specifics about an exorcism. All he would tell us, he remembers when he was at the house of the person afflicted, he felt like a deep, dark presence pushing on his chest. And then just kind of left that in the car. And you had like three kids in the back seat going, oh, we're totally going to be priests now. This is fucking, you know.
Right.
But I wish I had more, you know, memories of that conversation, because years later, I'm going to be looking back like, damn it, I had you in a car. Right. I had so many questions I could have asked, but instead I was, you know. So I guess that's my direct connection to one. I've never been one. I've never had one done to me. However, I guess that like if we talk about exorcism in a broad sense of the definition, we've, as Catholics, we've been part of minor ones. Yeah. That like there are sacraments that are, you know,
right,
like minor dispellings of bad spirits or bad, you know, evil influences.
Yeah. So there's a difference specifically in Catholicism between, there are essentially two types of exorcism. There is the ordinary or the simple, and that can be sort of performed by anyone. But baptism is an example of an ordinary or simple exorcism, more of a deliverance than an exorcism. And then the type of exorcism that we are most familiar with, and the one that we see portrayed in, you know, TV and film and movies and books, is what is called the solemn or the long exorcism. And that is the kind that you have to get, even if you are a trained exorcist, you have to get the approval from the bishop of your diocese to perform. But there's all sorts of like minor, yeah, those ordinary or simple exorcisms. I think baptism is the most obvious example. Just
like a little baby bat exorcism, you know?
Literally. Yeah.
Oftentimes, literally. Yeah, I was doing some research and reading. I'm on the website of, you know, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. And also, like, exorcist is an idea. It is through a number of faiths. We're speaking from, like, a Catholic, you know, standpoint, because that's our direct
disclaimer.
Yeah, exactly. That this is, that's our upbringing, what our point of view comes from that. But this is all over the world. There are many different cultures that all have some sort of like dispelling or rejecting of bad spirits from a body or a place or an object.
Still within the Christian tradition, in contrast to Catholicism, Anglican priests don't require any sort of permission from anyone whatsoever in order to perform an exorcism. And they also don't have it, like Catholics have the Roman ritual, the Roman rite for exorcism. And there isn't a sort of equivalent for Anglican priests. So they sort of can play fast and loose and play by their own rules.
We love that. Or we don't, because that can lead to some like pretty bad stuff.
Yeah, God knows.
It's kind of fun just to dive into, like, I already mentioned that they have to have the express, for an exorcism, that has to have the express permission of the diocese or the bishop. So what are, like, the steps? Like, if someone is possessed, if somebody, you know, played with Ouija too much, invited the devil in, what are the steps then to rid the body of the spirit?
Well, I think first, the Catholic Church specifically is very thorough, I think, in their investigation.
Very discerning.
Very discerning. They stipulate that you have to have a medical professional present for all of it, usually a psychiatrist, but sometimes a medical doctor, and then other sort of lay persons that are also involved, just to have different perspectives and, you know, be able to verify. And I don't know what the statistic is, and I'm sure every exorcist or person who's ever been involved with an exorcism will tell you a different statistic, but, you know, there's only so many in, you know, 100 or 1,000 cases that are determined to be, oh, we think this is actually a case of, you know, demonic possession or infestation or oppression or what have you. But that the real number is really quite small, but that's because they're very discerning about it, and they want to make sure that this isn't a case of mental illness. This isn't a case of somebody manipulating this for some sort of reason, for, you know, for some sort of benefit, somebody, you know, it's not a hoax or something. So, yeah, but I think then once it's determined that it is really, you know, that what they are dealing with is something diabolical, then the evidence for that are sort of the classic. And anybody who, you know, has consumed media about exorcisms will be familiar with, you know, the demoniac will use an unknown tongue. Which is not the same thing as speaking in tongues, right? So speaking in tongues is usually an example of like religious ecstasy, which I think is an interesting, you know, sort of two-sided coin. Like if you've been like touched by God and are having a holy religious experience, you might start speaking in tongues. But if you're having this demonic experience, then you might be speaking in languages that you have no reason to have known. The next thing would be hidden knowledge. So like if we were in a room and I was possessed and I was able to tell you what is in your pockets without having any knowledge of it beforehand. So things like that. And then some sort of physical power, usually strength, which is a difficult thing because, you know, we know of, there's certainly medical explanations for that kind of thing, right? You know, there's that famous example of, you know, the mother lifting the truck or the bus or whatever, you know, to save her child, you know, sort of supernatural feats of strength in moments of extreme duress. But that's sort of the classic third thing. And then there's some like additional criteria that could, or some additional manifestations that could come up, like thought transference. Suddenly the thoughts of the person who's possessed gets transferred to one of the people that's in the room, telepathy. And these are things that are not observed as often. So that's why they're not like the chief criteria. There's also something I came across that was like knowledge of an ancestral tongue. So perhaps if you, I mean, I don't know, depending on what your heritage was, you might suddenly start speaking in a language that is linked to, you know, your heritage, but that you have no reason to be speaking, which is a little different than just speaking any language that you're unfamiliar with. There's an ancestral link. And then, I think that's sort of it. There's some other things about like using, I don't really know how they test this, but like using parts of your brain or your body that are not normally used. So I suppose if you were paralyzed in some way, and then suddenly you were able to move that part of your body that you didn't have function over, that would be an example. But those are, I think, sort of all the classic signs.
I think this is interesting, this step, and what I think is interesting, and this could become just a bigger discussion on possessions versus exorcisms, because this is mostly, we're talking about like getting them out. But I feel like a lot of things you're describing could be double meaning as miracles, you know, that these are like,
sure,
that in any other circumstances, this is like a glorious thing that could happen. Like, oh my gosh, you know, you mentioned like if somebody was paralyzed and suddenly they could walk again, that would be a good thing. Whereas in the realm of possession, this is something that has to get out fast and out now.
And I think in most examples, the reason that the possessed is brought to the attention of someone else is that it's negatively impacting their life, right? And so sometimes the signs are not super obvious, and they present in ways that are sort of classic of various mental illnesses. You know, you might become withdrawn or apathetic, or just be exhibiting behaviors that maybe are not super extreme, but might be very out of character for you. And that's sort of the early warning signs. But of course, if you just witness that, you wouldn't necessarily, the first thing you would think of is not probably demonic possession. But then things get go from bad to worse, as they say.
They go pretty bad.
Yeah. Things can get pretty bleak.
But I think that's interesting because we're speaking mostly within the Christianity Catholic, realm of this. And I think it's also interesting to know, because you mentioned up that things get pretty bad, but like within the mindset of Christianity and Catholicism, possessed individuals are not usually regarded as evil themselves, which is like sets them apart a little bit that I've read or that they're not whole, that we recognize that they're not wholly responsible for what they're going through, that like there is some other influence that's making them do this. Whereas in other ways that it could be seen as that they are to blame for this, whatever, they're meddling in some other things, they're bad thoughts have led to their jealousies, or their unchaste thoughts have led to this sort of like evil presence taking over. Whereas within the Christian doctrine that an evil presence can take over the body without any sort of
without having done anything to bring it upon you necessarily. I mean, there's certainly like you can, I mean, there's a school of thought that is like, well, if you dabble in occult things, then you're obviously opening the door to doing that. Or if you're involved in, really, I don't know, if you were a serial murderer or something, like the very evil of the things that you are doing is drawing that sort of supernatural evil attention to you. But then there's also, other people who are leading perfectly ordinary lives and are nonetheless victims. I think it's also important to point out on that note of different faiths, different traditions, the Catholic Church doesn't really recognize the existence of spirits or entities that are good, whereas I think in other cultures you could be possessed by bad spirits or also good spirits, or if it's a culture, if it's a tradition that involves ancestor worship of any kind, like there can be inviting that sort of presence into you. Whereas for the most part in Catholicism, if there's some sort of entity or spirit or power that is trying to speak through you or work through you in a way that we would recognize as possession, it's almost certainly malevolent.
I think we've probably definitely talked about this in a previous episode, but now I'm just more interested in it again. Like, that's such a good point that they, like, we don't recognize that there are like good spirits. Like, what is there, like, is there a stance on like ghosts or like family spirits that, like, I feel like it's very much like my father or, other family members that have passed on there and they're still with us in spirit, or, that's a very popular thing to say. But like, is there any like truth to saying that within like the actual?
I think ghosts come up more often than not, they come up when we talk about needing to exorcise a place. Mm-hmm. So in thinking about like haunted houses, but if the living are encountering ghosts, those ghosts are usually manifesting as a result of having done something bad. Like there's something about their sinful nature or sins that they are attached to keeping them. We don't really talk about like visitations or visions of sort of your average person who is probably pretty good in life, having any sort of presence in the world other than, you might personally feel that, like, oh, I felt like their hand was touching me, or I felt like they were in the room, something subtle like that. But anything where it's like, I don't know, like a haunted house or even possessions, there have been possessions where it's determined that really it's the dead spirit of someone who was once alive. But again, that's always a malevolent presence. And then also in terms of poltergeists, that's more like the energy that someone's left behind. It doesn't really have, there's a less specific identity attached to the presence that's behind that activity.
Gotcha.
And also in the I think it's very common, or certainly it's very prevalent in the Catholic faith to, even if you were to encounter something that you maybe took for something that was good, you know, a good sort of spiritual presence or some sort of supernatural encounter that didn't seem obviously bad, that you're meant to regard that with a good deal of skepticism because, you know, demons are crafty, you know, and they might be trying to trick you, you know, it's that whole Hamlet seeing the ghost of his father, you know, and that whole going back and forth about like, well, was it really my dad or was it, you know, a demon appearing as my father trying to get me to do bad things? So, yeah, I think there's a healthy, or not a healthy, but there's a good dose of skepticism about having supernatural encounters that you might assume are benign, that maybe are malevolent in nature and you're being tricked.
So if one does find themselves like, hey, I am definitely being tricked by a demon right now, and I am possessed, there are steps within the Catholic Church to have an exorcism performed. We already established that they need express permission from the bishop or the diocese, that they will discern, they will make sure that there is no mental illness or psychological culprits behind whatever is happening, and then they will... So I'm thinking about who can actually perform the exorcism. A bishop can, and a priest that has been given permission can also, right?
Yeah, and I would assume that unless it's in an area where it just doesn't make any sense, it's just not possible if you're in a very small area or a very rural area, I would imagine that the bishop is only granting permission to a priest that has had exorcism training. I think that's probably a condition of the permission, is that like, oh, the priest in question is a trained exorcist. But I'm sure that there are, you know, special circumstances where it's like, oh, well, we live in the middle of nowhere, and probably the bishop for your diocese also lives several hours from where you are. And just, you know, given the resources, you could be allowed as just a regular priest to perform an exorcism, but I think that's probably it would be perceived as somewhat risky.
I did think it was interesting too, because I'm just going off this, you know, U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops site that has like quite a lot of information on exorcisms. I was like surprised. I thought it would just be like a couple paragraphs, but like they really went all in and answering all these different questions. But one of them I thought was also interesting, because we've talked about who can perform them. I thought it was interesting that like who can receive one, and they had like a criteria that like there's like a tier system, like Catholics, all Catholics, yeah, you're good to go. Or catechumens,
Pasco, collect $200,
you're also good. Yeah, exorcism. If you're, you know, it like, it feels like it, of all the steps, that if you are earnestly and like sincerely looking for help from a Catholic faith to clear the spirit, that they will go forward with it. I feel like, and that's, I think that's the requirement. And all, but I think that's interesting that it requires consent, you know, that like they want it to be gone, you know, like you said earlier, that this isn't something like a good thing. I also thought it was interesting that like it says in here, where should they be performed? And I'm so like, my visual vocabulary on exorcisms is so influenced by movies that all I think about is just like a bedroom.
Exactly.
You know, always. But they were like, right here in within their website, that they were like, yeah, they should be performed within a building that is dedicated to the church, and
ideally,
exactly, and it best to avoid the home of the person afflicted. And I'm like, that's so interesting, because every single, you know, fake exorcism I've seen has always been done in the person's home.
But it makes total sense though, right? Because you would think like, yeah, why would you want to like release that and then like, I don't know, it's bouncing around your house or whatever? Or it just seems like, why wouldn't you perform this in a place that like is already consecrated to God, that is already like, I mean, it's one thing to have a crucifix on your wall, it's a whole nother thing to be in the physical location where everything about it is you know, devoted to God. So yeah, it makes total sense. But it is funny that in the representations that we see in media, it's always somebody's bedroom or a hospital room maybe or something.
I do think it's interesting. And it also, I mean, it says right here that a small chapel is often used or discreetly hidden from human view. But I guess, you know, to give a throw a bone to all these movies, I guess the reasoning is that like by the time they need an exorcism, they're so far in, you know,
right.
The demon is entrenched and will not let them leave, you know?
And that's the other thing, too. I mean, there's such a wide gulf between what we see in media and what, you know, actual exorcisms are like. But one of the things that doesn't get talked about a lot is just how long that process can be, and that it can be really drawn out over days, weeks, months, you know, even years. Like, it can be multiple sessions, whereas, of course, in the span of, you know, a narrative on film or whatever, you sort of have to, like, have it be the climax or whatever, and you don't really see multiple attempts. It's not like a neat and tidy process, and I think the outcome is very uncertain. Yeah, and not always successful. There was a there's a famous British case. Let me see if I can find it. I had read about it. Oh, here, I found it. I'm just going to read this little disturbing story. It's just this one paragraph. This is from the book Demons, The Devil, Possession, and Exorcism by Anthony Finlay, which is it's a little dated. It's from 1999, but it tells this story of Michael Taylor, whose strange and irrational behavior in 1975 led to his being exorcised by two inexperienced clergymen. One of the exorcisms lasted all night, at the end of which the exorcist claimed to have driven out scores of demons from Taylor's body. They believed they had succeeded totally in freeing Taylor and had restored him to normality. In a mistaken euphoria, they left Taylor alone with his wife. That night, or early morning, he attacked his wife with such ferocity that she choked on her own blood. He gouged out her eyes, tore out her tongue, and ripped the flesh from her face. Later, Taylor was deemed to be insane. So, that...
Jesus!
Yes, a very graphic... Yeah, sorry, I should have done a warning, but... Because that is a terribly graphic story, but a tale of exorcism gone terribly awry.
And that's within a sanctioned exorcism, too. I think that's an interesting thing we can get into in a little bit. So yeah. Unsanctioned exorcisms, which is like it's a big problem. I also think it's interesting, before we get too far away from this, is that there is a degree of secrecy around all this, too, not only from like a place hidden from view, and like you're saying, like their actual right, but also around the people involved within it. I'm reading right here that this question about asking if exorcisms are kept confidential, and it says like, yeah, for the integrity of those individuals, confidentiality is so important. They also strongly suggest the identity of the exorcist be kept a secret, so then they are not inundated with random calls and inquiries. And right. Then I just flash back to that car ride with the car and the priest, and how he was like, so like, I'm not going to tell you anything about it, which I'm like, right. you definitely did one then. I know it now because you didn't tell me. But I think this, like, all of this secrecy going back to then unsanctioned exorcisms, like, can go the opposite way, that like, because there is so little reported on all of this, that the problem could be much bigger than it actually is, that we actually know. Yeah, I think that's really scary, because the exorcism is all about like driving something out of the person, and the tools in which to do it are from a Catholic standpoint, it's using holy water, icons, the word of God, because they are vessels through the word of God, dispelling them. But in these more, fanatical interpretations of an exorcism from an exorcism, it could basically be torture for the person.
Yeah. I think it's also interesting to note that the only reason that within the Catholic tradition that exorcism apparently works, or that it's even a sort of the rule that the whole thing is predicated on, is the acknowledgement that demons are subject to a higher authority, you know, that they are subject to the authority of God. And I've had this question that comes up in my mind occasionally, and I don't know when I first thought about it, but it comes back to me every now and again, and I just think, what if everything we thought we knew about exorcism was wrong? And that's why, you know, and perhaps that accounts for, you know, exorcisms going wrong, but because the whole thing is just sort of, it's predicated on that idea that it works because demons are beholden to the power of God. And if exorcism is even real, if demons exist, if all of that is true, I mean, I would hope that is the case. But I think it's interesting that, like, that's not, we just sort of take that for granted that perhaps that's the case, but who really knows?
Yeah. I think it's also, it's scary too, that like, because so much of this is a religious right or is a religious act. There are so many protections for different religious, you know, activities, that like, a lot of this can go if we are wrong, you know, in like mm-hmm. the faith, that if there actually everything we do know is wrong, it still goes unchecked because of religious freedom. I think one thing first thing that comes to mind is I'm going to bring it right back to this film festival that I was just at, because there was a movie that happened there called Godless, the Eastfield Exorcism. And it's all about this true story of this exorcism that resulted in the poor woman's death, that was unsanctioned by the church. It was a radicalized Christian local church that that believed this woman was possessed, tried this exorcism. It was a brutal, horrible thing. And the movie follows, you know, this one, the woman that's going through this, but also her husband, that is the one really at odds, or like struggling, you know, with his own faith of like, do I trust the church that is saying that I need to do this, or do I trust my wife? Fascinating movie. I think it's going to come out in VOD if you'd like to check it out, called Godless. But at the end of the movie, it also brought to light all of these other real statistics of all the documented cases of unsanctioned exorcisms that result in death. And they're usually children or women, you know, that it's never it's never a young man that gets that has to go through this. And going back to like what you're just saying, that like, what if we're wrong? I think that in this situation, they're absolutely wrong, you know? And but because just like a demon will use and exploit different things, I feel like this, if there is any good from a good exorcism, it's being exploited to also allow these other murders that happen, you know?
Yeah. It makes me think about one of my favorite exorcism movies, and maybe one of the very first ones that I ever saw, if not the first one, which was The Exorcism of Emily Rose.
Yes. I just rewatched that last night, actually, for this.
Did you? Yeah. I was revisiting it a little bit, and I always had such affection for that movie, because I think it's a really interesting question of how responsible, you know, because it's a trial for a priest who had this young woman under his care, and she was reportedly possessed, and she died under his care. And so it was trying to determine if he was criminally negligent. And she had various medical conditions. I think she has epilepsy. And part of the difficulty was that they realized, or they believed, that the medication that she was on, and I think they name a drug that is not a real drug, but I'm sure it has an actual real life.
They called it Gabapen.
Gabapen, or like Gambutrol or something.
Yeah, or something,
Yeah. Also, the first time I ever saw Sheree Agdashloo, she's that she's one of the witnesses that
she's wonderful.
Talks about. But yeah, but I think that's the first thing I ever saw her, and obsessed ever since. But anyway, they determined that the medication that she's on keeps her in such a state that she is unresponsive to the rite of exorcism. It keeps her from being able to respond,
mm-hmm.
which is. Puts everybody in a hard place.
I think that's really interesting, thinking about like, because exorcisms, if you want to think of it from, we're talking about like the actual spiritual practice of the getting rid of demons or, you know, unclean spirits that are in the body. But also like there's, you know, talk that like realms of thought and studies that exorcisms work as a act of like a placebo, or like they are, you know, the power of persuasion, and that like, if that was the case and would have worked for, you know, Emily Rose in this case, that like, if that's all she needed was someone, you know, to believe that she wasn't possessed anymore, and then it would have been good. And this drug is keeping her from getting there. It's just like, it's a messy category when we mix these two things together.
But I must say that I think that movie has one of the best exorcism scenes as far as portraying an exorcism as close to what it might look like in real life. It's a fairly untheatrical, in the sense that, you know, there's no spinning heads, there's no pea soup, there's no, I don't even know that there's much telekinesis, and there's no sort of like, her eyes dilate a little bit, but most of the time she exhibits, you know, extraordinary strength, and she does speak in several languages that she has no business knowing,
right?
And Yeah, it starts in her bedroom, as we know all exorcisms in a movie and films must, and then it progresses to the barn on the family property, and they try
as all exorcisms do.
Yeah, yeah, and the weather is dramatic, right? Like, you know, you're supposed to believe that, like, oh, it's stormy because of the supernatural forces at work, but it also could just have been stormy that night. But yeah, as I think, as far as like other exorcism scenes in other movies, even ones that really try to treat the subject matter with a degree of seriousness, don't get as realistic as that one is. And in the, I can't remember if it's true of the actual case that it's based on, but at least in the film, part of the difficulty that that Father Moore faces, played wonderfully by Tom Wilkinson, is that he assumes that she's only possessed by one demon, and he keeps trying to extract the name. And Emily keeps counting in several different languages, and she keeps counting to six. And then you realize that she's counting to six because there are six of them in her. And so they have names. It's not just one name. And I don't remember if that's actually true of the case that it's based on, but that also is something that has, I guess, biblical precedent.
Yeah, because the case that was based off of was Annalise Michel, which was a Catholic woman in Germany who was said to be possessed by six or more demons, subsequently underwent a secret 10-month-long voluntary exorcism. I think that's also interesting that I remember seeing from this movie too, is that it showed that, like, it's not like a one and done thing, you know, an exorcism.
Right.
It's not like the priest doesn't come in, unfold, you know, the little scarf and, you know,
the scarf.
Yeah. And then throws the holy water and is like, you know, out damn spot. And then they're all done, mm-hmm. you know, it's,
Gosh.
They're usually, I mean, it'll even say so on the Catholic bishop's site here that it can be years long ordeals of routine praying and commanding. But go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, that just makes me think of just sort of talking about it casually. It makes me think of my favorite exorcism film, which is The Rite, 2011's The Rite, starring Anthony Hopkins, mm-hmm. The critics were not particularly kind to, but I watch it several times a year. I think it's fabulous. But the first sort of exorcism that you see, Anthony Hopkins is very casual about everything. It's very sort of, like, he even takes a phone call in the middle of the exorcism. He's like mid prayer and his cell phone rings and he stops to take the phone call and he like tells Colin O'Donohue, who's sort of this skeptical seminarian, to like you know, take over whatever while he speaks in Italian on the phone. But yeah, that I think is realistic in the sense that, not that priests would be taking phone calls, but that it's just like one exorcism appointment of like someone that he's
been
seeing for several times. And you know, the demon doesn't always manifest in these sessions, but it is something that can progress over, you know, weeks and months and possibly years. And in that case, you know, that, I mean, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen this movie, stop this podcast now and go watch it immediately. But, you know, that woman dies, which his character says is the ultimate goal of the demon, is for the person to be killed, which I don't necessarily know is actually true. I think that I'm sure demons don't mind if the person dies, but I think if humans are supposed to be, you know, like the temple of God made manifest, it's a way of desecrating that temple. You know, it's a way for the devil to enter into the house of God and just desecrate that space.
Absolutely.
So, but yes, that poor woman does die, but then that allows that demon to then move on, and it attaches itself to Anthony Hopkins, and we get a wonderful performance of Anthony Hopkins being possessed by a demon, which I would like more of in my life.
Yeah, I think, I don't know his beliefs, but I feel like if I was ever possessed, he would be the one, you know, I would call to. Just like, I don't know if you, I know you're not a priest, I don't even know if you believe, but I just feel like you'd be a good job at.
Yeah.
Just kind of like talking to him, you know?
Yeah.
You know, when you also said that these are like routine appointments, you know, that they can be, it also just like made me think, like, that's just therapy, you know? We're trying to get our demons out, you know?
Yeah. And in the way that, like, the therapist doesn't want you to project your issues onto them, and or you don't want, you know, any sort of transference, right? I think that's the clinical term. You also don't want that in a spiritual sense. You don't want spiritual transference where the entity has hopped from one to another. And I also don't know, you know, how realistic that threat is or how easy that is. You know, there's so much of it that, I mean, on the one hand, if it's even real, and on the other hand, if it is, the mechanics of all of that is so mysterious, you know, how all of it really works, because even there's just so much guesswork involved, even with exorcists and believers who have done it. You know, there's only so much that they're ever going to get to know about how that all works, especially because it's not like, you know, when you catch a criminal, you could like interview them afterwards and like find out more about like the criminal mind or whatever. You sort of don't really get that luxury with demons. And I don't think they are probably wanting to explain themselves.
That's also the hard thing with these, you know, you say that especially within these true stories of exorcisms that end in death, and that we can't discuss them. Going back to what you were saying earlier about like, what if we're wrong about all of this, that if it always ends in death, you know, that like, I'm not saying it always does, but I'm saying that so many of these, that it is known to happen, whether it be from the acts of the exorcising person or through the, like in the case of Annalise Michel from Germany, the real life story, she died from malnutrition and negligent manslaughter. Like she only weighed 68 pounds when she died. It was horrible. And so like all of these different things that like, yeah, there's rarely on the other side of it going, what was that? Tell us about the demon, you know?
Like, right.
There is no afterward. It feels like this is just like another form of, I guess, therapy, and not always successful.
Yeah, certainly not.
We brought up a couple real life cases, but there are cases of, I guess, success from famous individuals that have had successful exorcisms. Salvador Dali reportedly had a minor exorcism. So there we go. He even created a sculpture of Christ on the cross and gave it to this friar, this Italian friar that did perform it as a thanks.
Wow.
So look at that. There was the, I guess, Mother Teresa allegedly underwent an exorcism late in life.
Yeah, I heard that.
The Archbishop of Calcutta noticed apparently that she was extremely agitated in her sleep and feared that she might be under attack of the evil one. But that was late in life. I don't know if it worked, you know?
Right.
I don't know. Again, we can't ask.
Nightmares? Yeah. Yeah.
it's becoming a recurring problem that we can't ask if they work. Yeah, I'm looking through this list of all these famous people that have been gone through exorcism. And it's so funny because they'll mention a name and they go, based on this movie or from this movie or...
Right.
Which might be a good segue in just talking about our, like, it's you and I, big horror fans and horror movie fans, and we were raised Catholic. So we've seen a lot of exorcism movies. And so I thought it'd be fun to, like, talk about, and whatever that means to you, your favorite exorcism, you know, movies, whether it be, like, the portrayal of it or the, just like you said, you love The Rite. So that's your favorite.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And I think, well, one thing that's sort of interesting, speaking of The Rite, is that Anthony Hopkins and Colin O'Donoghue sort of get into this conversation about after that first session about what's really going on. And Colin O'Donoghue is very skeptical and he thinks, well, she's clearly been abused. She's pregnant. You know, he has all these rationales and Anthony Hopkins sort of comes back at him and he says, it's sort of convenient that when no proof of the devil becomes proof of the devil. And I think that's sort of interesting, like in terms of like, how do you actually prove what's really going on? And Anthony Hopkins, you know, says something to the effect of like, well, when somebody comes and burgles your house, does he turn the lights on when he does it? No, right. He shows up when it's nighttime and it's dark and he sneaks in, you know, if he's in, gives his job, and he does it so that you'll never know that he's there. And so you would think like, why wouldn't the devil, you know, operate in the same way? So they sort of seesaw back and forth about that philosophical debate, and they both in that film deal with their own skepticism, their own atheism even at times. And I think that's an element that isn't always represented in these sorts of stories. But
I do think it is represented in like successful versions, you know. I think like
definitely.
I rewatched watched basically the whole Exorcist and all its sequels leading up to this podcast. So I rewatched The Exorcist and I was reminded all the ways that like, yeah, that it is in the devil's or the spirits or whatever, the demon's best interest to like throw off the scent a bit, you know, that like,
yeah.
That like there was even a part in the movie where Father Karras, he throws the holy water on Regan, and she's freaking, you know, she screams and starts speaking in tongues. But then when they're going back, you're like, oh, this is proof. Look, boom, you know, this is, but they you got her, dead to rights, got the demon, right. You know? But then Father Karras reveals that, like, that wasn't holy water. That was just tap water, you know, right. that it's even messing with the priest a bit, you know, that like,
yeah. As long as Regan believes that she's possessed, she's going to act as if she was.
Exactly. You know? And so I think it's just fascinating. And I love the different ways of like the first scene where Father Karras sits down with Regan and the demon opens the drawer at the bedside table.
Yeah.
And Father's like, did you do that? Why don't you do that again? And the demon's like, in time, you know, mm-hmm. And he's like, no, do it right now. He's like, no, in time. I think it's, yeah, the game of it is always the fun part of these exorcism movies, you know?
Speaking of The Exorcist, I don't remember, because I'm sure we've had this conversation before, but did you ever watch when FX did their Exorcist TV series?
No, I never did. I know you've seen it, yes?
Yes, and I was so disappointed that it was canceled because I thought it was really good. And one of my favorite things about it was that it sort of creates its own exorcism lore. I'm always interested because there's so much that's derivative in this genre specifically, so I'm always looking for the thing that like is putting a little spin on it or delving into, you know, a question. And two of the things that I think it does really well is that one of the concepts that it introduces is that, you know, classically there's different levels of demonic possession, and I'm not going to remember the order of them, but you know, there's oppression and obsession and infestation, you know, there's all sorts of those things. But they in the series they introduce integration, and that is an idea that doesn't have any basis in, you know, in actuality, but that is when the demon completely takes over a person and there is no chance that they will be the demon has essentially banished that human's, you know, soul, and that demon is now walking around in that person's body forever, and there's no way that and that comes into play because there's this secret cabal of people who are working to replace people in the world with these demons, and they're performing these ritual murders, and they're taking these organs from these people that they've murdered, and they are burning the organs, and they turn them into ash, and then they all sit around at a table and they perform this thing called, they call the ceremony of ash, or vocare pulvere, I think, and they somebody breathes into the ash and the ash sort of goes up into the air, and then and it's sort of animated by a demon, and then it decides which one of them it's going to possess and claim, and then they sort of open their mouth and the demon goes in the form of that ash goes into them. So that's something just sort of like enriching a little bit of the lore. And then the other thing that it introduces is that in the Catholic tradition, so much of exorcism is about, it's all command. It's all, you know, the power of Christ compels you, and, you know, and demanding of the demon. It's, you know, you're really taking a stick to it. And it introduces this character of Sister Bernadette, I think her name is. And she's this older nun. And she, I can't remember which character, I think it's Ben Daniels is in it. Ben Daniels plays sort of the older priest who's had a lot of experience, because it's an older priest and a younger priest, very much like in the Exorcist movie. I guess her like ethos behind exorcism is approaching it with compassion as opposed to commanding. And so when she performs exorcisms, she approaches the demon with compassion, and I don't know that she tells the demon that she loves it, but she sort of like is this forgiving, kind, empathetic presence. And I think it's effective because I think the evil doesn't know what to do in the face of that sort of compassion, that sort of empathy, and in the idea of forgiveness, or like the idea that like God loves you, you know. And I think I think it's frightening, you know, to be to have to face up to that. And I think it's so much more easy to battle against something that's like, oh, the power of Christ compels you. And I think the demon can be sort of like, oh, fuck you. But then when it's like,
they often do so.
God, yeah. but then when it's like, God loves you, and, you know, you're loved, and, you know, and speaking as much to the person who is possessed as to the demon itself. And that's just something that I had never seen before portrayed in exorcism, is approaching exorcism with a compassionate mindset instead of a commanding, sort of domineering. And it's a very, you know, patriarchal versus matriarchal sort of approach to the same thing. And I think as a result, it's much more risky because she, you know, it's not like tying up the victim or whatever.
Right.
She gets up close and personal. And so she incurs a lot more, you know, physical risk that way. But I think that her results are better because it seems like it's just a more effective way of performing exorcism. And I think it makes sense that, you know, of course, a nun is going to come up with that. And of course, you know, this patriarchal system, this, you know, clerical system of, you know, this male dominated priesthood is always going to come in with, you know, the power of Christ compels you. And perhaps that's not the best way to go about it.
I love that. I love that the other, I guess, a more nurturing, loving form of exorcism.
Yeah.
And I think of, like, things that come to mind are, first thing that came to mind is, I don't know if you've ever seen Kubo and the Two Strings.
Oh, yes.
Stop motion movie. And at the end of the movie, they defeat the old, you know, manned evil wizard boy by basically just telling him, in a way of lying, but they're just, they basically have the whole town saying, like, no, you're a good person, or like, no, you are a loving father, you're this and this, you know, that, like,
yeah.
And like just rewriting the story for him a bit, you know, mm-hmm. that, like, cause sometimes it just takes like a recognition that you are good, you know, and that that can be a step in, because it's, you know, the bringing it back to exorcisms, that just like the power of Christ, if you're playing the fire with fire, you know, it might not
exactly
work.
Right.
I also think it's fascinating that this is part of the Exorcist TV show, because, and this is just a great moment I want to plug because I'm a big fan of Charisse Castro-Smith, who has produced the show. And then she went on to write and direct Encanto, which I feel like employs a similar way of solving problems, you know?
Yeah.
So I just think that's fun.
And challenging narratives.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So no, but this is on my list. I definitely want to watch this show, and I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it yet.
The other one that it made me think of in terms of like exorcism being approached in a non-traditional, and by traditional, I mean non-Catholic traditional, non-Roman rite way, is in Grady Hendrix's book, you know, My Best Friend's Exorcism, less so the movie, which should have been so much better than it was, but we don't have to talk about that.
No, we don't have to.
but the book offers this really beautiful, something that could so easily be corny becomes something that is so emotional. And it's basically a secular exorcism in that, you know, because it's about this group of girlfriends in the 1980s in South Carolina, and one of them becomes possessed, and her best friend, you know, is, you know, sticks with her through this whole thing, and horrible, horrible things happen. But she ultimately links up with this guy who's part of like a, they're like dudes who like work out for Jesus, and they're sort of like, I don't even know, but they'd be like televangelists sort of, but they also like are gym bros. Anyway, she tries to go for him to help to sort of exorcise her friend, and he sort of pulls all the classic Christian exorcism techniques, and it's just not working. And so the friend, she, her sort of last ditch effort is like, she invokes all of these things that are sort of sacred and holy to her friendship with this other girl. And it's things like that girl's dog. And it's like, you know, by the power of, you know, your dog Max, and by the power of the Go-Go's music, and by the, you know, it's all of these sort of like secular things, but that are really special and linked to their relationship specifically. And that could so easily become, you know, like I said, you know, corny or trite even, but it is so emotional. I just remember crying when I I think I was listening to the book, you know, hearing all that. It's so affecting, and takes you by surprise, because you think like, how is this going to work? Like you've tried everything that you could, you know, that's possibly within your power to expel this demon. And then that's the thing that does it. And so often in, you know, even I would say, even in like my favorite exorcism film, The Rite, the way that the exorcism works, you know, suddenly the young character, the seminarian, he, you know, he's forced to acknowledge the existence of the devil. Anthony Hopkins, you know, forces him to reckon with the fact that like the devil is real. And then he sort of does the logic of like, well, if the devil is real, then God has to be real too. And if God is real, then I choose to believe in him. And that's sort of how he wins the day and exorcises Anthony Hopkins, which is a little, you know, it's a little convenient. It's it's like, why did that take you this long? Anyway, I just feel like oftentimes exorcism stories don't necessarily end in a way that lives up to everything that's come before in the film. You know, it sort of gets tied up in like a, sometimes a dumb way, or sometimes just a way that's too convenient. But I just found that in My Best Friend's Exorcism, it was a really poignant, really beautiful example of a secular exorcism that uses all of the language of the Roman Rite, but then instead of, you know, the power of Christ or, you know, in any sort of like Christian language, it's just things that are important and sacred and holy to these two young girls. And that's the thing that does it. And I just think, what a brilliant example.
You know, I love that. I think that's, I mean, it might even be considered, you know, blasphemous or a little sacrilege, but like using by invoking the power of your dog or your favorite band, that these are things that do have power. You know, these are things that you do like give an adoration to. And then sometimes that can be, you're going to give more adoration to something that you can see and feel and love than like, a divine almighty that I think a lot of the demons will take advantage of how quiet he is,
Right.
I watched in all the Exorcist sequels, prequels I watched, there are two prequels, technically. There's Exorcist, the beginning, and Dominion, a prequel to The Exorcist. And they're basically the same movie. I don't know if you know the history of this.
Which is the one that, isn't Stellan Skarsgård in one of them? He's like young Max von Sydow. Which one is he in?
Yeah, so yeah, Exorcist the Beginning. It started off as Dominion, prequel to The Exorcist. And it was a Paul Schrader movie, which Paul Schrader also did First Reformed, which is an incredible movie to talk about exorcism and environmentalism. Paul Schrader's take on this story was very much, he's honing in on the more quiet existential woes of The Exorcist versus like the flashy pea soup stuff. And the studio didn't like it.
Flashy peas.
Exactly. And so they fired him halfway through filming and basically recut the whole movie for Exorcist at the Beginning. And that was directed by Rennie Harlan. The movie did not do well. The budget was $50 million. And it made $76 million. So considered bust, even though it worked very well on my sleepover party. Two of them are not priests. But with the story is roughly the same. The difference is in Exorcist the Beginning, it's much more flashy. It's much more like Hollywood, you know, like, demons. After the failure of this, the studio went back and gave money to Paul Schrader to finish his version of it.
Oh my God.
And you can watch it. It's on Peacock. Dominion, prequel to The Exorcist. There's the special effects are pretty jank. It's I'm not going to say it's a great movie, but I think there's really good stuff in it that, like, I think there's the ideas in Dominion are much more exciting than the, you know, blockbuster version of the beginning. Right. And this is all a long-winded way to go back to a big part of the prequel Dominion was that the Pazuzu, he's doing such a good job at like complete in this small, town in Africa at this dig site of like everybody involved and everybody in the vicinity of like completely breaking them down to being just completely hopeless, you know, that like and fully believing there is no God, because how could there's even a part in the movie where a room of school children. Indigenous children that are being indoctrinated with the Christian faith at this school. And one of the local indigenous warriors comes and kills all the kids because they didn't want this plague of Christianity to spread. And then there is a father that comes and he's weeping and he asks the priest, Father Marin asks, like, does your God allow this to happen to the most faithful? And Father Marin goes, yes, which is like, such a like I don't have that, there's no answer to that, you know, that like if and there's so many other moments of this that like the Pazuzu in this case is doing so little. And in fact, the times that he does show up, we brought up earlier with the miracles, there is a crippled local that gets to walk, gets his hands back, gets his legs back. He is possessed by Pazuzu, but everyone sees something glorious and not something scary. And so It gets messy, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, much like Midnight Mass.
Exactly, just like Midnight Mass. I think it's worth a, you know, if you've got an afternoon and you want these kind of cool ideas, it's not a great movie. I'm not going to say it's not like a, an amazing time, but it's certainly a lot better than the sequel Exorcist II, The Heretic. I don't know if you ever saw that movie.
I never watched that one.
I think you can miss it.
I think I've only seen one and three.
I watched it. I watched the whole thing 2 days ago. I still can't tell you what it was, what it was about.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I can't remember. I can't remember anything from that movie. But what I do remember, and you were talking about how these movies, a lot of Exorcist movies, that have a really hard time ending in a satisfying way. I think The Exorcist, the OG, I think still has the most satisfying ending and brings another part of exorcisms we mentioned, which is transference. And at the end, you know, Father Karras accepts Pazuzu into him and then kills himself in the process. And that's how he saves Regan by doing so and heroically rids, you know, the demon of a vessel. I still think, and it's people still take pictures by the stairs, you know, that are in Georgetown that like, yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited to see what else comes from the series, because I mean, this is funny. What's up?
Well, because we are getting a reboot, right?
We're this year, which people may have mixed ideas on this, but yeah, from the creator of the most recent Halloween trilogy. David Gordon Green is directing and, you know, producing this new reboot of The Exorcist. But I think it's got potential. I think it could be cool because Ellen Burstyn is coming back. That's exciting. Right.
I mean, yeah, that's always exciting. Do we know that it's, I mean, if Ellen's coming back, do we know that it's, is it retelling Regan's story or is it a continuation of, much like the Halloween, the new Halloween
movie? It is a sequel. It is a sequel to the first movie, very much like the Halloween movies. The IMDb storyline says it's sequel to the 1973 film about a 12-year-old girl who is possessed by a mysterious demonic entity, forcing her mother to seek the help of two priests to save her. That is the story of the 1973 movie. So I guess that didn't tell me anything about this new one. But the cast is exciting. Ellen Burstyn's going to be in it. Leslie Odom Jr. is also in it, and so is Anne Dowd.
We know it's going to be good.
I know it's going to be.
It's Anne Dowd.
It's got a fire cast, and there are rumors that Linda Blair may be in it, which hard to believe because she's publicly very, you know, famously said she wants nothing to do with the series anymore. Which I do not blame her. I don't know if you've ever watched a behind the scenes of of what she went through to make that movie, but it was horrible. She broke her back.
Oh my God. Well, that makes sense because the only reason that I'm skeptical about this is just that I thought that the FX TV show, which is, you know, a sequel to the first movie, I just loved everything they were doing with it. So I'm very pleased with what already exists. So I'm just sort of like still bitter that like, wait, why didn't we just keep doing that? But spoiler alerts. I've already told you this, but spoiler alert for the viewers. If you don't want to know anything more about the Exorcist TV series, then stop listening now. But Gina Davis is in it, and she just plays this mom whose daughter becomes possessed, and it's revealed later that she is Regan all grown up. That's and she so has cool. a different yeah she has a different identity. Yeah, so cool. And also great to see her. You know, I think it sort of happened at a point in her career where it was like, where has she been? What has she been doing? And she really delivers, and there's a lot that she has to do, and there's a lot of different hats that she has to put on in that role, and she gets to flex a lot of good acting skills and whatnot. So that's quite fun. And I think you sort of see it coming, but I remember it does feel like a sort of jaw-dropping moment when she finally reveals that's her identity. But yeah, I was happy with what she did. If we couldn't have Linda Blair come back, I thought, that was a good choice.
Yeah, absolutely. These are more reasons I want to watch this TV show now, and I'm probably going to do it this weekend. This is a good year, 2023 for Exorcist movies. We're just talking about later on this year. We got an Exorcist reboot. We've got The Nun 2 is coming out, which if you liked The Nun, I wanted to like The Nun so much.
I liked parts of it. It's hard not to like. I'm like, a Romanian monastery. I'm there.
On paper, sorry. It's a perfect movie for me. It like checks yes. every box. Romanian yes. castle, spooky nun, Indiana yeah. Jones story. It turns into, you know, like.
Yeah. I sort of wish that this is sort of interesting in that it's not really it's certainly not an exorcist story, but it's not a possession story. But if anybody's ever seen Black Narcissus.
Oh yes, oh my gosh, that is a great story.
But that's sort of what I wish the nun had been.
100%.
Like that, but more obviously more heavy on the supernatural, which is really just a suggestion in Black Narcissus. But Black Narcissus less is very cheap gothic jokes, but
scares more yeah. Sexual tension with priests.
Yeah. yeah, less spitting the blood of Christ into the face of a demon nun and more, right. Yeah.
I do think there's, I mean, that those are all to later on this year. This week, well, that's, I think, another reason in honor of hosting this podcast this week, we've got The Pope's Exorcist starring yes. Russell Crowe.
I can't believe we went this whole time without mentioning it, since ostensibly no. that's sort of the reason why we're doing this. I meant to bring it up at the beginning,
like in honor of the Pope dispatching his strongest soldier, we are going right. to talk about. Other Exorcist movies to put on your radar, personal favorite, I love Exorcist 3. I think yes. it's wonderful. It's written and directed by the writer of the original novel, The Exorcist. And it's like a police procedural. Or it takes,
George C. Scott is so incredible. Oh God,
he's so good. George C. Scott, and he goes into this psychiatric ward and is trying to like hunt down this Gemini serial killer. It's wonderful. And it's got maybe the best jump scare maybe ever.
Oh, yeah.
Highly recommend Exorcist 3.
That's funny that I just made the connection that George C. Scott is in that film and his son Campbell Scott plays the prosecuting attorney in The Exorcism of Emily Rose.
That's so true. Yeah, it's so funny. I also think that The Conjuring is a great example of exorcism. I think what's great about that one and what scared me the most when I saw it in theaters was that it really broke down the steps and gave you like kind of like the tier system and how one would become to possess that it, you know, it starts with like, you know, that they will break down the host until it finally accepts them because it can't resist it anymore. I think that was all like the portrayal of that I thought was very scary and well done. So
yeah,
the Conjuring 3, maybe less so.
but
the first one, still great. Still great. Yes. I just read this week that there's going to be a Conjuring TV show.
Which also reminds me, and maybe you're already going to say this, but a sort of less traditional, I guess, exorcism story is we're getting another Insidious, right?
Yes, we are.
And because that does involve exorcism, it's just it goes about it in a much more sort of like dark fantasy way rather than a religious way,
which made me starting to think when I was compiling my list of like what are other things that are exorcism adjacent, what are other things that are like expelling bad things, you know, but maybe aren't like out damn demon, you know?
It crops up in all sorts, you know, like I don't know, like Lord Voldemort possessing Harry Potter, mm-hmm. you know, like it happens in all sorts of different stories.
I think about, there's a movie that came out a few years ago called The Wailing, South Korean movie, very scary movie. And that's very much dealing with a little village that is possessed by an evil spirit and the rituals that they do to dispel that. And that one, I think that might be on Shudder. I think that's where I saw it.
Oh, I'll have to check that out.
The Wailing is very good. Highly recommend The Wailing. What are some other ones? I'm trying to...
Oh, well, talk about like an unsuccessful exorcism that's very disturbing, but in The Witch.
Oh, yes.
When
absolutely.
Thomasin's brother comes back from being in the woods with the witch and he's sort of undergoing, I don't even know what you would call it because it's not even necessarily possessed. I guess he's more sort of bewitched, but the family are trying to bring him back and they're trying essentially to give him an exorcism even though they're not trained in that, and I don't know how familiar they would even be with that tradition or those ideas, but very very disturbing and very unsuccessful.
I think another one, bringing it back to books a bit, is A Head Full of Ghosts, which we read in our book club.
Oh yes, indeed.
That one is which you, at the end, it's a reader. You decide if it was a successful exorcism or not.
You decide if it was real or not. Yeah. Exactly.
That one's wonderful. If you haven't heard of Head Full of Ghosts, which I swear we must, if you were a podcast faithful and have heard us talk about Paul Tremblay, we're big fans of Paul here on the podcast. You'll know that we love this book, Head Full of Ghosts, starring these two sisters that the older sister is maybe possessed, maybe not, but it is bringing the attention of a local TV crew to document a real life family, you know, possession and the ridding of it. And the story is all told from this perspective of the younger sister and wondering, with all the unreliable narrator, you know, tricks that would come from a story being told by, you know, an 8-year-old girl that is in that situation. It's a wonderful story. Love that book so much. Yeah. And at the end, that's another one where like, I don't know. Was she ever possessed? Is she still possessed? Is the sister now possessed? Who knows? You know,
there's another book that I haven't read it in a long time. I should probably reread it, but it's called A Good and Happy Child by Justin Evans. Yeah. It's been a while. I don't have like a tidy summary, but about this, you know, 30-year-old man who is sort of in crisis, and he's just had a baby, and he's not really bonding with his infant son. And I think he goes to like several therapy sessions and starts like thinking back about his own childhood and weird things that happened in his childhood. And I think starts to become suspicious that, oh, hey, maybe some of that weird stuff that happened when I was a child is the result of demonic activity. And maybe my sort of imaginary friend was maybe more than an imaginary friend, and maybe all this stuff in my past is the reason why my life is sort of out of sorts now and I'm not bonding with my child. But yeah, A Good and Happy Child by Justin Evans.
That sounds icky.
Yeah,
not a fan of that one.
You prefer your exorcism stories non-icky?
Yeah, non-icky, yes, please. Thinking about some other ones, we went and saw The Devil's, what was it called? The Devil's Staircase? Is that what it was?
No, isn't The Devil's Staircase, what is that? That is something, but that's not what
it is. It is something. The Devil has so many parts of the house. Yeah. But yeah, we saw...
Oh, that's good.
I'm trying to figure out. Oh, Saint Maud is another one that comes to mind.
Yeah, which is more possession than I think. I don't know that there's ever an attempted exorcism.
No exorcism. So I guess that's more of a possession.
But it does. But it does deal with that idea of, it's at least the first time I can think of the idea being presented that like, what if possession, demonic or otherwise, feels good instead of bad, and what that might mean. And yeah, that we are just so used to seeing like examples of possession, you know, that it's horrible for the person who's undergoing it. But
right.
I think that's an interesting idea of like, yeah, but what if it felt like ecstatic? Even if you ultimately were doing awful things that you weren't necessarily fully in control of, what if the experience of it in your body was that it felt really good? I think that's an ickier thing to sort of be confronted with, and we don't really get to see that represented very much. But yeah, Saint Maud, check it out.
Yeah, it's usually the icky version that we are. It's like, oh yeah, we got to get that out pronto. But like, what if they don't want to get it out? Yeah, I think we pretty much covered like the big ones. You know, The Conjuring, Exorcist.
Okay, but wait, back to The Devil's Staircase, because there are several things that relate to The Devil's Staircase. Most of them geographical locations. There are a few movies, but are you thinking of the movie that we saw in Brooklyn?
Yeah, in that that really cool movie bar that is now.
Yes, closed. It's
in, The Devil's Doorway. Like, is that what it was?
Yeah, maybe it's The Devil's Doorway, and it's in
another
Ireland,
part of the house,
right? Another, yet again, another part of the house. What does he not have?
He's got.
Remember, like, look for like the devil's eaves, the devil's gutters, the devil's,
yeah, devil's doorway is definitely what it was. Gosh, there's so many. The devil, dude.
He must be so bored.
So bored, right? Well, we've covered kind of the big ones, and watch us like, you know, wrap this up now, and we're gonna be like, oh my god, of course we didn't talk about this.
Oh yeah,
and like, oh, I would have loved to talk about this. I think the big one that I want to mention is Evil Dead 2. You know, Ash's hand gets possessed and he does what he has to do and he chops it off with a chainsaw. that is a possession if I've ever seen one.
Well, right. I feel like with since we talked about it before on a previous episode, and I would be remiss if I didn't mention Penny Dreadful.
Big fan of Penny Dreadful.
Moment of silence for Penny Dreadful.
You loved how it ended.
Yeah, famously loved that. Yeah. just kidding. Horrific. But the point is that in the first season, there's a great exorcism scene performed to the hilt by Ava Green, who knows no peer, where are all her enemies. But what starts as a very, I don't know, classic sort of Catholic exorcism that does not work, then becomes just a one-on-one between her and Ethan, who I don't think at that point we know is a werewolf, which actually isn't. I didn't even need to say that. It's not germane to the exorcism. But the point is that she sort of begs him to. She doesn't see any hope for herself. She doesn't see that she's going to be relieved from this oppression by the devil, and so she asks him to kill her and to shoot her specifically with his gun. But he has a St. Jude medal. You know, St. Jude, as people may or may not know, is the, you know, patron saint of lost causes. He uses that as his sort of like icon with which to exorcise her, which is really sort of beautiful in that, like, she sees herself as a lost cause, and he's using that, he's taking that and answering that with, like, okay, well then let me use the thing that is specifically for lost causes. And it works. Of course, many more awful things befall poor Vanessa Ives, but at the end of season one, that's the exorcism there.
And what a performance by Ava Green.
Like, what a performance. Everybody, I recently rewatched that scene, and Josh Hartnett too, doing that. It's the two of them, they had insane chemistry, and were so, so good together. Everybody in that show.
So many people have done an exorcism movie. I feel like that's always a mark when you have a memorable possessed performance. I think that, like, Ava knocked it out of the park. You already mentioned the exorcism of Emily Rose with Jennifer Carpenter. I think she does a horrifying performance.
Incredible. And with so little, there's not a lot of special effects.
No.
So much of that is just really her performance. It's
the contortions of her body and the positions that she finds herself in. Like, really, really upsetting stuff.
I don't even know that her voice was altered at all. I think I kind of want to believe that that's all her. I don't know if that's true, but I don't think that the voice modulations are that drastic. I think that it's believably within her range. I don't know that they didn't modify it, but I wouldn't be surprised to learn if it was all her.
I wouldn't doubt it. I think she really
she can probably even make her eyes dilate like that at will. I'd believe it.
Obviously, Linda Blair, we already mentioned. For what she had to go through for that performance. If you one thing to leave you with this podcast, if you haven't, on Shudder, there is a documentary called Cursed Films, and the Exorcist episode is one of the best and really goes down to, like, all the stuff that happened on that set. A great piece of history of all the horrific stuff that they went through. So check that out. This was a fun talk, Connor. I enjoyed talking about this, and I thought this is kind of an overdue one, and it just seems like it's in the air this year with The Exorcist coming back and Russell Crowe, Gladiator, our finest soldier getting in the ring.
Yeah, I think, well, we've already talked about this a bit. Like, I don't really have high hopes for that movie, other than I do expect to see new things done as far as, like, exorcism lore and mythology and tradition, and maybe some things that, like, haven't been explored before. They may be executed poorly, but I'm sort of in it as much for the ideas that they present as I am in the execution. And another part of me is a little bitter that I'm like, why isn't it not just like another, like The Right Two? Why didn't we just bring back Anthony Hopkins to have another go?
Maybe he'll have a cameo at the end, and then we have our extended
Right universe. Would be amazing.
You know? You know? Our own DCU, you know? Or MCU. There we go. Fucking superheroes. Yeah. I've just ruined movies. Anyway. Thank you, Connor, for coming on, talking about exorcisms. Yeah,
great to be back.
Thanks all for joining in. Connor, do you have anything coming up that you'd like to plug that we could put in here?
Imagine if I said, I'm actually about to attend an exorcism next week. So
thoughts and
prayers, everybody, please. I'll be doing a full expose, so you'll get all the behind the scenes, you know, all the things they don't want you to know about exorcism. No, all that is to say, I don't have anything.
Okay.
Sorry to disappoint everyone.
No. Thank you so much for joining us. If you enjoyed this podcast, if you enjoy Happy Harvest Horror Show and you want to help us out a little bit, just go to our Instagram, Happy Harvest Horror Show on Instagram, and you can find our link tree there and all the necessary links. And supporting our podcast gets you access to our super fun book club, where we meet once a month to talk about a spooky book. We'd love for you to join our little group. So just going on over there, even supporting at $1 gets you access. But thank you again, Connor. And thanks all for listening to our spooky little podcast. We'll see you next time. Bye.